This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. Today's episode will have a little bit of a mixed structure. First, I'd just like to talk about some news regarding environmental legislation that has implications for wildlife and their habitats, and an opportunity for you to make public comments. On September 10th of this year, Secretary of the Interior Doug Burgum announced the Bureau of Land Management's intention to rescind the Conservation and Landscape Health Rule, commonly referred to as the Public Lands Rule. This rule is a recent piece of natural resource policy that came into effect in June of 2024. So here's a description of the rule in the Bureau of Land Management's own language. The Conservation and Landscape Health Rule establishes the policy for the BLM to build and maintain the resilience of ecosystems on public lands in three primary ways. 1. Protecting the most intact functioning landscapes. 2. Restoring degraded habitat and ecosystems. And 3. Using science and data as the foundation for management decisions across all plans and programs. One element of the public lands rule is the addition of conservation leases to the BLM's framework for land use. This is a new tool for restoring landscapes and mitigating the effects of other activities. Conservation leases essentially provide a formalized pathway for third parties, be that nonprofit conservation groups, tribal organizations, or state agencies, to lease public land so that it can be allocated for protection or restoration. Now, this is similar to how these lands can currently be leased and allocated for other uses, like mining, timber extraction, oil and gas development, and so on. The rule explicitly specifies that conservation does not take priority over these other uses. Conservation leases cannot override pre-existing land use designations. Additionally, once in place, these leases don't necessarily preclude other uses in the same area, so long as those activities are compatible with the conservation project. Instead, the rule levels the playing field so that conservation can be incorporated into the BLM's multiple use framework, which is consistent with the Federal Land Policy and Management Act of 1976. There are two types of conservation leases, restoration and mitigation. Together, they account for the only two purposes for these leases, and that is respectively to restore degraded public land or to offset the impacts of other land use authorization. Restoration leases remain in place for a maximum of 10 years, but can be extended if necessary to meet the original goals of the lease. Mitigation leases have no maximum length and are instead commensurate with the activity they are mitigating. The public lands rule fulfills its goals in other ways, too, directing land managers to identify areas that need restoration and go about providing that, prioritizing places based on land and water health and benefits to local communities. The rule also conserves already healthy landscapes, supporting wildlife, habitat connectivity, old-growth forests, and ecosystem function. It makes better use of the Areas of Critical Environmental Concern, or ACEC, designation. It also applies the research-based fundamentals of land health to all renewable resource management. Before the rule, these fundamentals were applied only to grazing. Approximately 245 million acres of public land in the United States is overseen by the Bureau of Land Management. That's about 40% of public land, all of which would be implicated by this policy change. Within Montana, that's 8 million acres across the state. In an article put out by the Department of the Interior, Doug Burgum is quoted in stating that, quote, "Overturning this rule protects our American way of life and gives our communities a voice in the lands they depend on," end quote. In reality, it does just the opposite. Built into the public lands rule are frameworks for the public and local communities to engage further in how their neighboring landscapes are utilized. Additionally, the BLM states that the rule, quote, "requires meaningful consultation during decision-making processes with tribes and Alaska Native corporations on issues that affect their interests, including the use of indigenous knowledge," end quote. According to an article released by the Center for Western Priorities, the public lands rule was widely supported in public comments during the initial drafting stages of the legislation. 92% of those comments reportedly were in favor. As I mentioned, we are in another comment period now in response to the proposed rescission of the rule. Those comments must be submitted by November 10th. I recommend reading more about this. Look at the legislation itself, see what's at stake, cross-check what different groups and stakeholders are saying. Many environmentalist and naturalist organizations are advocating for the preservation of the public lands rule, keeping these conservation tools in the toolbox. They advocate that rescinding the rule is anti-productive to sustaining the many ecosystem services these public lands provide, along with their intrinsic value. I'd like to dedicate the remainder of this episode to an excerpt from Dr. Dominic De La Sala's recent speakership, hosted by the Gallatin Wildlife Association this past fall. The full presentation is now available on the GWA's YouTube page. This 20-minute excerpt will distill some key information, and I hope it will encourage you to check out the full thing, especially if you were not able to join us for the original event. Dr. De La Sala is currently a Senior Conservation Science Associate at the Conservation Biology Institute. He has authored over 300 peer-reviewed papers and 9 award-winning books on forests, climate change, and endangered species. He's given numerous plenary and keynote talks, including for the United Nations. His recent work focuses on the Northern Rockies and the unprecedented convergence of climate change, inappropriate wildfire and forest management, and humanity's cumulative ecological footprint that is transforming the integrity of the bioregion.
I've been doing a lot of work in the U.S. on what we call ecoregion conservation assessments. It's something that I worked on with a team of scientists back in the 1990s when I was at World Wildlife Fund. I'm now at the Conservation Biology Institute. And when I was at WWF, we were doing these ecoregion assessments to figure out where biodiversity was especially concentrated and what to do about it. So I've resurrected that, brought it back, and put a climate layer on it. And so far, we've been publishing these ecoregion conservation assessments, ECAs. We did one for the Mogollon Highlands in Arizona, 2023, I believe we published that paper, and that's been helping the groups there deal with developing robust conservation planning for a changing climate. We published the one for the Southern Rockies that are helping the groups in the Santa Fe region with their issues. That was published in 24. And we just published the Northern Rockies ecoregion conservation assessment this year. And those are all in peer-reviewed journals. And so I'll be talking a little bit about that. I haven't really done much work in the GYE recently, so that's why there's a kind of a blend here with, okay, I know what we've done in the Northern Rockies. Some of it could overlap with the GYE, so that's why there's a blend presentation here. So hopefully it applies to some of the things you're concerned about. Next slide, please. Okay, so some of the projects I've been involved in that are of interest. We did this one with Bill Ripple that was published in 2022, which was a rewilding plan for the entire western U.S. And these are different overlays of some of the conservation priorities we were looking at, like wide-ranging large carnivore species, connectivity, the amount of carbon in the system. How can we connect all of this across the entire West? So sometimes we operate at this scale, the entire West. Sometimes we switch over to Yellowstone, the Yukon, and you guys are anchoring the bottom here of that initiative, which has been quite successful since the early 1990s. And it's important to think of your region as more of a biome. And sometimes we will clip out sections like Crown of the Continent. Other times we will focus on just the U.S. portion. I mentioned we published the Northern Rockies Ecoregion Conservation Assessment, which is just to your west, and we used this to help the groups to propose a climate refuge, thinking that there would be a second Biden term that would allow those groups to have the science to go forward with a climate refugia proposal to the administration. And then we also mapped the mature and old-growth forest over NREPA, when that was a live policy issue, trying to get the Biden folks to protect mature and old growth and filling in the gaps between what they were proposing and what NREPA was proposing. So all of these different conservation strategies are in the mix, as well as what GWA is proposing with their 7 wilderness study areas and the roadless areas that are in your region. All of it is part of that plan to stop the hemorrhaging. And we know now, after doing this for many, many years, we need at least 50%, 30 to 50% of these landscapes in strictly protected areas. You guys are around 12% the last time I looked. So there's a big jump. And the roadless rule was really important to closing that gap. And now we're faced with the opposite, with the administration rescinding the roadless rule. So I'm going to try to really zoom in as much as I can on the GYE and the importance of this place, because when I was with WWF and we were assessing the biodiversity of places in North America, to see how important certain areas were, you guys were continentally significant. Because a lot of that is because the largest remaining intact blocks of habitat, of areas without roads, are in this region. And you know them all. You've been to them, and you've been fighting for these places for years. You've got the charismatic species, you've got the geothermal features, and you got the anchor to the Y2Y proposal. So it's all important. Whether I'm working here or any place else in the Rockies, these places are irreplaceable. Back in 2012, Reed Noss and I did this paper in conservation biology. We wanted to see all the different proposals at the time that were out there in terms of what different regions were talking about for their protected areas strategy. This is before 30 by 30 and 50 by 50. And so what we concluded was the median was 50% of all these different regions to achieve their conservation goals. You can see I've listed those here, which is representation of different ecological units in protected areas, connectivity, population viability, and then buffers around your protected areas. This conservation biology approach is what got me started as a graduate student in the late 1980s, riding the wave of conservation biology, a new science. And fast forward, I don't know, once it's been 40 years, oh my God, 40 years, and it's still relevant, right? Now we just have to add a climate layer to it. And so getting to 50 by 50 means filling in the gaps. And so you need to know where those gaps are, which is why we conduct these assessments to figure out, okay, here's the distribution of the protected areas. Here's the places that are really important in the area. Do they line up? And most times they don't. Some do. And I mentioned we did this in the NREPA analysis for the groups that are working on that proposal and overlapped it with the mature and old growth forest. We were the first team to map mature and old growth forest in the United States, even before the Biden administration did. We already had three papers in publication, which just kind of made me laugh when they said, first analysis ever on mature and old growth forest. Really? You guys really are like the fourth one, not the first. But anyway, it was kind of interesting because their analysis showed twice as much mature and old growth forest than we did. And I was like blown away. But they were looking more at pinyon juniper, and we did not include pinyon juniper in our analysis. But they used FIA plots, inventory plots, and we used LIDAR. But it was really cool to see the feds do this. It's too bad they dropped the ball on that proposal. It had a lot of problems, but they were moving in the right direction. So we want to get to these big, hairy goals, right? And we know that it's either 30 by 30, 30% by 2030, or 50% by 2050. In some regions, it's going to take more. Like the Amazon, they're talking 80%. If you're talking old growth forest, you need it all, 100% on federal lands. But in general, this is what we're talking about if you're going to have a functional ecoregion during an advancing climate storm. And so all of these factors would add up to getting to that goal. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about the ecoregion assessment that I mentioned from the Northern Rockies, which is just to your west. But what we did is this kind of assessment. They had a bunch of conservation priorities. We overlaid the protected areas. We discovered the gaps. We included focal species that they were interested in, wolves, bears, wolverine. And then we threw climate projections on top of it. And that's what you see here, are these, all these climate projections, using downscale climate projection information. And the bad news is that the place is really heating up, right? You can kind of go through the summertime temperatures right here, about a 2 degree centigrade increase during this time frame is projected. But as you go out towards the end of the century, it gets really gnarly. In general, just multiply by 2 to get the Fahrenheit, roughly. The precipitation is a little harder to predict. The models are inconsistent on that. You try to get the best model you can, but basically more rain on and less snow, a reduction of the snowpack, which is happening across the Rockies, and more droughts. and that means more fires. And so how do you prepare for this, right? You don't throw more emissions into the atmosphere by logging, and, you know, big, beautiful coal is not the way to go with this if you really want to have a functional system. Well, one way to plan for it, and this applies across all regions, whether you're here, whether you're a little further west, or whether I'm talking to folks in the tropics, you want to make sure you've got the principles of conservation biology in place. Large, interconnected, protected areas. Roadless areas. Many of the roadless areas have climatic properties, especially the ones that have old-growth forest in them. We know that the temperature inside old-growth forest is cooler. The humidity is higher. The absorption of the soils from moisture and retention is greater than if you're in a clear cut, right? So climate refugia, you don't want to be in there building roads, because you saw what happened in the previous slide with what happens when you build roads. You want to make sure that you maintain focal species viability. In this region, it could be a whole collection of different focal and iconic species, but you want to make sure that they have habitat, they have interconnected landscapes that they can get through without facing mortality sinks. We all know what happens to grizzly bears when they wander into urban areas, for example. You want to maintain your mature and old-growth forest. And then we've got to prepare communities for the worst of the climate shift. And I'll talk a little bit about that. Okay, so I'm going to shift gears now. I've got not only a scientific perspective on this, but in 2020, I had a surreal experience with fire. We were in the middle, in southern Oregon where I live, we were in the middle of a heat dome, high winds, cross-continental, which are unusual where I live because of the climate-related shift in the jet stream, ostensibly. We were in a drought situation, and I was writing an opinion piece. I was in front of my computer, and in the middle of that, my power went off. And naturally, I went outside, even though my lines are buried, went outside and took a look. And there it was, the Alameda fire had knocked on my doorstep and took out half of my town. 3,000 structures in a single day. It was structure to structure. It had nothing to do with the forest. Millions of dollars were being spent in the backcountry logging, and yet my town burned down because it had nothing to do with the trees. It was all structure to structure, and we're seeing this in many places. The LA fires, we did an analysis on that. And the LA fires have been used to justify fix our forests. 1% of the landscape in the LA fires was forested. The rest of it was chaparral, oak woodlands, having nothing to do with forest. Yet it's being used to justify that huge logging plan in the legislation. So we know now that we can generally predict fire seasons by knowing extreme temperatures, the springtime melt of snow, and the vapor pressure deficit, which is the amount of moisture in the atmosphere, drought. When those conditions are operating and you throw in high winds, get out of the way. Because if there's a spark, you're not going to get that fire out. And no amount of logging is going to slow it down. These are fast fires. We have a paper coming out in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that says the dead trees that we've been hearing about that need to be taken out to prevent these fires have nothing to do with fast fires because their crowns are already free of foliage. So to get a crown fire, you need crown vegetation. And if your needles are dropped, you don't have a fire problem. And yet those get blamed all the time too. And so the amount of logging to actually change fire behavior, even when it's not in extreme weather, let's say it's low to moderate fire behavior, you hear, well, thinning, reduce fire intensity. Yeah, that might be the case, but think about the emissions that you're putting into the atmosphere, which at a large scale are more emissions than the fire event itself that you're trying to prevent. And we've done carbon plots to prove that in different high-severity burn areas, most of the carbon transfers from the live to the dead pools, and that it doesn't go into the atmosphere. You see those big plumes of smoke, a lot of that's water vapor. There's black carbon in there, but a lot of it's water vapor. And a lot of the carbon just goes from live to dead pools, and a lot of it remains in the soils. So to change fire behavior in extreme fire weather, even if you could do it, you'd be putting out so much emissions and changing the forest to such an open area, it doesn't even look like a forest anymore. And so I wrote an article about this in Biological Conservation in 2022. I used the Sisyphus analysis. We are becoming the contemporary Sisyphus, thinking we can stop these fires by logging, and it's not going to happen. We might even make it worse. What you could do is you could just track the spending of fire suppression over the decades and the acres burning. Both of them are going up. Now, don't get me wrong. We really need firefighters to help our communities. But when you're doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome and you're throwing more and more money, you're not treating the root cause. You're treating the effect. And you're going to have a difficult time pushing that boulder. We actually are in a fire deficit compared to historical conditions. And you can kind of track how fire just kind of follows the vapor pressure deficit or the amount of moisture in the atmosphere. You got dry periods, like the early 1900s Dust Bowl. Look at all that fire activity. Then you got this break mid-century. It was a cooling trend in the Pacific weather systems and a drop in fire activity. This is when a lot of the house building was happening. The Forest Service was becoming militarized and industrialized in fire suppression and beating its chest, saying we can put every fire out the next day. Was it by 2 p.m., whatever it is? The 10 a.m. policy? Whatever that time was. So we were getting really confident, and you had all of this ex-urban sprawl, lack of zoning, lack of planning. And this is the perfect storm because we built all these homes in the wrong places with the right intention. Everybody wants to be in the wildlands. Man, it'd be cool to live in the forest. But it's become this real major public safety and fire risk problem, including half my town burning down. The other factor involved in here is the amount of access for roads. And one study showed that, look at how many different human-caused fires. 84% of all wildfires during this period were caused by people. 370,000 miles of roads on the National Forest System. Maybe we've got too many. And there are all kinds of impacts. In the Sisyphus article, we looked at impacts before, during, and after wildfires. Every time we intervene in a forest system like this, it comes with ecological consequences. It's basically what it says, including bulldozers in wilderness areas. It's really hard to get vegetation back on these. They become de facto roads for ORVs. They become places for weeds to run. We call those road runners, and not the funny bird that moves around, but all of these different invasive plants tend to be along the road system. We have chemical retardants impacting the aquatic system, fuel breaks that become roads, all the soil damage. Then it's associated with post-fire logging, cows, ORVs. David Lindemeyer and I coined this the cumulative disturbance burden that ecosystems experience in our 2025 publication, that these systems have a limit. Yeah, they could be resilient, but you can only push them so far before they will flip to a different state, a degraded state. Now, I was in Congress years ago, and I got shouted down about protected areas. Oh, that's the problem. We got too many protected areas. You can't get in there and manage them. They're all going to burn down. We got to get in there and manage them. And I walked away from that hearing, and we published this paper. I forget what journal it was in, but we simply took a look at this. Let's look at fire severity in relation to land use. And what we found was the opposite of what those Congress people were yelling at me about. The areas with the most logging had the highest amount of burn severity. The national parks, the roadless areas had lower burn severities. This is the problem, not that. And yet, this is the focus of legislation.
You can watch Dr. De La Salle's full presentation on the Gallatin Wildlife Association's YouTube page. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found on its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.